You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Living on Gumbunya country in Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sandy. Welcome back to Talk the Walk. My guest today is Dr. Antonia Hendrick. Antonia is a social worker with over 20 years of experience in research, family and community practice, and policy settings in both government and non-government organisations. She is currently a full-time lecturer in the School of Occupational Therapy, Social Work and Speech Pathology at Curtin University. Antonia's passion includes working with people in community at a grassroots level to action developmental practice, which she also teaches in the School of Social Work course. Her most recent focus is on decolonial practice, partnering with Aboriginal elders to develop staff and student cultural responsiveness. Antonia has a number of publications on decolonial theory and practice and aims to develop this work in the academy. This work intersects with her interest in eco-social work, where she's a member of a special interest group through the Professional Association. While Antonia is a member of the Social Farming Network group, which I'm completely fascinated by, it is her experience working alongside elders in decolonising the social work curriculum that I'm really looking forward to hearing more about today. So welcome to the podcast, Antonia. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for your invitation to speak with you. I'm speaking from Whadjuk Noongar Boodja.
Beautiful. What's the country like there? Can you describe it?
Today is warm. It's green and beautiful day. And the Christmas trees, which I don't know the Indigenous name for, are starting to flower, which are amazing.
Oh, gorgeous. So there's been a long-held view that the social work curriculum needed to be Indigenised to incorporate an Indigenous worldview, as it's very white. Can you talk about some of the factors that led to the Department of Social Work at Curtin University to decide that this was a process they were very committed to?
So there were a number of factors that led to the developments to decolonise, and we came to the idea of decolonisation rather than Indigenise social work, because it is critiqued for a number of reasons. So in 2012, the Australian Social Work Education and Accreditation Standards, the ASWEAS, stated that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander ways of knowing, doing and being as an essential core curriculum area. So soon after about this period of time, at Curtin, students were saying things to us in the course like, can we have more content? We actually need more content on ways of working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. There was a core group at this time as well of students who put out a survey to survey their peer group to see what the need or the want was for this further information, and it was quite significant. And it was sent to our head of school at this time as well. Staff at the same time were saying things like, you know, having an Aboriginal guest lecturer in, the odd case study or a vignette or an assessment in the units was not enough. And actually we needed to do more. So in 2014, so this was all at about the same time these events unfolded, a national project led to an evidence-informed roadmap for the development and delivery of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander ways of knowing, doing and being in social work curricula, and it's called the Getting It Right Teaching and Learning Framework. This framework was what was the catalyst for us as a staff group to think, okay, we need to be able to do things differently in this course to embed Indigenous ways of knowing, being and doing.
Yeah, it's so great to see that this is happening because I remember in 2005 when I graduated, just stepping out soon after flying up to the Territory and thinking, I'm feeling so underprepared. So I'm so thankful that these students were actually speaking up and asking for this kind of thing. It's great. So what were some of the first steps for you as a member of staff at the university in getting the project off the ground?
Well, there's a couple of parts to this project. So it did, as I mentioned, start in 2014. So the Getting It Right team came to Curtin University, where we had a round table to promote the framework. And the staff group who attended were really moved and shifted in our way of thinking about what this actually means and how we might action this work. So we took it upon ourselves to meet as a staff group, and we brainstormed what it looked like. So we took the framework, we applied some of the concepts in the framework as to how do we go about doing this in the course. One of the things that we kept coming back to was we don't have an Aboriginal staff member to consult, and even knowing that even if we did, one person in themselves is not enough to really get a good understanding of how we might go about this work. We all knew of an Indigenous Yuit man, doctor, who actually is associate professor now, Michael Wright. I went and consulted with him, and it was just timely because at this time he was involved in the Looking Forward project. Now, if you Google that, you'll find a link to some of the reports and information and the framework. Mm-hmm. But his work was focused on the southeast corridor of Perth, and services were saying to him, mental health services were saying, you know, Aboriginal people in this corridor are not accessing these services. Why? And so Michael's PhD, it started with his PhD, was to look into why people weren't accessing services. And what he came to realise was that actually Aboriginal people were not trusting of the services. So he began to explore this further with elders and family and community in the area. And they devised a framework for working with services. And what that looked like was elders working with senior personnel, so managers, CEOs and senior staff in organisations in this corridor, and yarn with them mm-hmm. about their storing. So that was the first part of what was happening in the Looking Forward project. And Michael, when I went to meet with him, said, you know, what it sounds like you want to do is similar to this project. So how about I talk with the elders and see if they'll come and have a yarn with your staff group? You get buy-in from your school and I'll have a yarn with the elders. So that was the first step, really. And so we were able to secure an amount to pay for the elders to come and yarn with us over a period of a year. That was the first step, really, mm-hmm. in our relationship. And it was just profound in our understanding. And being social workers, you know, there's this assumption, I guess, from graduates and possibly staff members that this is our bread and butter. We know how to be culturally appropriate. We know how to work in this space. Mm. And actually, yarning with the elders was really a game changer, because there was so much learnings and unlearnings in that journey together that really was quite transformative for a lot of the staff.
Yeah, right. So can you speak about what those first meetings were like that you had with the elders? If I was a fly on the wall watching, what would I have noticed about the way you were working together?
It was a very different way of coming together. There's no set agenda, although there probably is an agenda of sorts. There are time frames, although there aren't time frames, so it's loosely bounded. So it was very different in that, you know, there's this Western framework and very westernized and neoliberal way of operating and working in this institution, which has become a big business, and then meeting with First Nations people on their terms in a different way of knowing, doing and being, which actually was very different. It was exhilarating at the same time as really challenging. Sometimes you felt like you knew where you were going, and then other times you had no clue. Mm-hmm. So I guess for me, I felt like I was a facilitator of bringing the two groups together in some ways, because I'd had the discussion with Associate Professor Michael Wright, and he did the work with the elders on engaging them and asking if they wanted to come and work with us. Mm. So I was holding this hat of facilitator, chair, thinking, okay, well, staff are time poor. Staff are going to have some anticipation or want some kind of guidance around what this might look like. These were my own assumptions. Mm-hmm. And what I quickly realised was actually I needed to unlearn. I needed to let those things go and just be present, sit with the elders and do the storying with them. So what that looked like was sharing who we were. It was about who we were in a space together, how we connected, how we could share some storying, how we could learn to trust one another. quite a profound way of working very differently.
I'm reminded of one of the published journal articles that you've written where you describe the work of developing this framework for teaching and learning as becoming an ally, so becoming an ally alongside Aboriginal people. Can you explain what you mean by this and why it's so important?
So we all come from our own particular worldviews, our own cultural lenses, whether we're aware of that or not aware of that. So this work on becoming an ally is something that I've come to think about of myself in this space, in this work. So what is it that I bring? What is it? What are my own assumptions? What are my own values that underpin this work and my ways of being with other people? So I really needed to have some frameworks and understandings for unpacking that for myself. And so there was some really critical works that informed this work. So Anne Bishop's work on becoming an ally, Claire Land's work on decolonizing solidarity, and Glenn Singleton's Courageous Conversation. So really, those three things come together for myself and Sue Young around the imperative of critical self-awareness, that we actually need to understand and clearly articulate what our own values, beliefs, experiences and biases are in able to join with others as supporters in this struggle. But it's also about our relational selves. So there's the reflection on self, but then there's the reflection on our relationships with other people and how we relate. But what comes with that is that there are no expectations that in that relation, in our want to be supporters, that those offerings might be unwelcomed or not accepted. And being able to sit comfortably with that, given the history of this continent, and that it's a joint struggle, that it's not about helping per se. And I think social work graduates can think about social workers as being a helping profession, and to a degree it is, but if we unpack that a little bit more, it's not necessarily about helping and wanting to do good, although we do. It's about being change agents, political actors in the work that we do to reconstruct our own interests in partnership with other people together. So it encompasses a sense of self-rule and a process of self-formation, I guess. And it's flexible and fluid. So how I think about this work now can shift and change depending on my own learnings through this journey, because there's no end point to that.
So if people would like to know more about this framework of becoming an ally and how to do that, would you recommend they read the authors that you've mentioned?
Each of them has a book on each of those topics. In our article, it clearly talks about, well, it synthesizes to a degree those books, but of course you'll get more from each of those authors. So that's in Decolonizing the Curriculum, Decolonizing Ourselves. So this is coming from experiences of our own teaching and learning in the in what we talk about as being the third space. So we come up with our own framework for working ethically at a interpersonal level, at the micro self level, but also at a political structural level as well.
Great. So I might put some links to where people perhaps could track down those resources at the end of our show notes today, if people want to read more about it. I'm interested in hearing about some of the outcomes, I guess, of the work and what it is that's changed, particularly in the school, as a result of being able to work alongside Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the development of the new social work curriculum.
There were some really profound outcomes. But first of all, let me give you a little bit of context. So I talked about the first stage of the staff elder engagement process over that period of the year. At the end of that time, the elders and the relationship and the partner had really been built. There had been a level of trust, a level of reciprocity that had been formed as a result of our yarning together. So the elders at the end of that time said, okay, well, what we would really like to do now, having heard about the surveys and the interest from students, is we want to engage with students in a similar process. So what we did at the end of 2016 was we co-designed, developed and delivered a project to include students. So throughout 2017, the elders were involved in that process centrally, And there was a series of yarning that occurred with occupational therapy and social work students who were in their final year of their courses. The idea being that they would be in service learning, so they'd be on their final placements, and they would have a series of yarning with the elders pre-service learning to be able to engage and develop skills in yarning, develop rapport with the elders, so that when they went out on placement and then came back in for further series of yarning, they were able to open up. Our aim was for them to open up and develop their own cultural responsiveness by asking questions, sharing stories in that space, and really exploring more deeply their experiences of placement. So that occurred in 2017, and the outcomes were quite incredible in terms of our aim was for the project to increase the knowledges, skills and confidence of students towards their own cultural responsiveness, and all students did report on those outcomes. They talked about it as being transformative. They talked about it as being unlike any unit of study, that it wasn't assessed, and therefore that it meant that they could be really present with the elders. At an organisational level as well, there were some significant changes. So we needed to, as a research group, work with administration staff within this institution. So this is what I call is Wodjila work, so white person's work, in that, you know, human resources needed to be, we needed to develop a relationship with people and say this work is with elders, so the turnaround time of a month payment is not adequate because these people are not part of an organisation. So HR staff became a part of this change process where they understood and became familiar with, you know, quick turnaround in payments. So there were structural changes, graduate changes, and personal changes for all of the staff involved. So what was critical for the success of this project engaging with the students was that some of the staff who were in the earlier staff elder engagement were also a part of this other part with the students as well. So there was that continuity and relationship that continued through that process.
I'm really fascinated with what that would have looked like, students and elders sitting together. That would have been an amazing conversation to hear. I wondered whether that gave students permission to ask questions that perhaps they have been wondering about for some time but just didn't feel confident in asking.
Absolutely. So it was really interesting. We the elders, myself and some of the team, research team, are currently writing this up. We've got a good draft together, and that's going out to the elders for their review at the moment. So we hope to get this published at the beginning of next year. But really what occurred through that process was that students talked about in the first instance of feeling their way through this new pedagogy, this new Indigenous way of knowing, being and doing, which was interesting, exciting, but also a little bit, you know, they came with trepidation. They didn't know what to expect. So the first three yarning sessions were similarly experienced to that. But then with the generosity and the skills of the elders gently guiding students through, towards the end of the yarning, the number of yarning towards the end, students really opened up. They did ask the really hard questions. They didn't feel fearful of saying an inappropriate thing because they had already experienced the elders holding them really carefully and gently. Mm. And I'll share a story. One student who was placed in a rural setting where there's a large population of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, came back. It was a short-term placement. She came back into the yarning following placement with a very different disposition, and she actually took charge in some ways of that session, which was totally appropriate, but she started by apologising to the elders. It was really profound, and the apology was, I've listened to you storing, I've listened to you sharing with such great heart and generosity some of the atrocities that have happened to you and your families and, you know, the history that has impacted upon you today. And I disbelieved that. I didn't understand or realise that it could, that kind of thing could happen. So there was this disbelief in her listening, although she was hearing being said. But when she came back in, after placement, it was, I am so sorry. I am so sorry that I did not believe you, because I've seen this racism. I've experienced watching this, and I am deeply sorry for firstly not fully believing you and accepting those stories. But it was just, it was a really remarkable testament to the safety that was that occurred in the yarning spaces, but also her growth, her own sense of self and reflection. So it was really courageous for her to do that, but a real game changer in terms of her shifting towards becoming an ally.
Yeah, right. I'd like to shift focus a bit now and talk about you. And what's it been like for you to be involved in this project? Can you speak about some of your own learnings and how this has influenced your practice as a social work researcher and academic?
I feel extremely honoured and privileged, and that's a bit overused, that word, and in different contexts, privileged, but that's exactly how I have felt being a part of this project. Being in the same space with the elders is quite a humbling experience, and definitely filled with lots of learnings and ability to reflect on self and your relational self with others. So it has been I've been really honoured that this has been work. And while there have been some challenges for me to navigate the systems of, you know, neoliberalism, which is time poor and so on, and about efficiencies, this space has enabled me to really understand how important, because I know this theoretically, of course, and we teach it in social work, how important relationships are, but this is demonstrative of that. This is how it works. This is what it feels like. So it's an experience rather than something that you can necessarily describe. So I think those things are reaffirmed for me in this space. So there has been some deep learning, and taking that into other spaces in my work has been something that I've been able to do as well. So, you know, just understanding the importance of taking time to listen and develop those relationships with students, despite the fact that we're given a formula of only, you know, a set amount of time to consult per person and so on. So it's bringing that really important aspect into our work and modelling that for students as well.
And you did mention that there were some challenges, so I'm going to ask you about that. What do you think was the biggest challenge for you as an academic engaged in the process of decolonising the teaching of social work in the school?
Yeah, I think there are a number of challenges, and I would have to say that most of them are structural, because it has felt as though the project is something that is really manageable and very doable and quite economical, in terms of it doesn't require a lot of money or resources. It is really about relationships, and it is about time. So the headbutting happens at the structural level. So how do we build this into an overcrowded curriculum? Mm-hmm. How do we bring it into an institution where, you know, pay models are really finite and stringent and oppressive in lots of ways? So it's finding those avenues that have been really difficult. And the elders really want to be able, they're committed to this project. They've really felt as though there has been significant change, which is profound for them as well. They are committed and want to continue this work in the school. How we go about doing that is really difficult, because there is no more funding. So it's about locating funding to be able to continue this work. Other structural issues are around not having an Aboriginal staff member within the social work department or occupational therapy school or speech pathology. So there are some really important structural changes that need to take place for this work to continue. So I guess they are the biggest challenges that we're facing here.
It sounds like it's moving beyond decolonising just the curriculum, but actually decolonising the whole school and the structural issues that impact on being able to deliver a curriculum.
Yeah, and I guess that's the importance of Michael Wright's work and the Looking Forward project, is that one of the premises is that elders need to be sitting and yarning with the CEOs, with the power bearers, mm-hmm. with the VCs of universities, with the CEOs and managers, senior personnel, because that's where the change and that's where the decision-making layer occurs. And that's where the change, the cultural change, can happen.
Yeah, so what effect do these challenges have on you as a practitioner or just even a human being?
It can get emotional. It can get emotional because I see the importance of having representation from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and I see the oppressive structures and some of the decision making and some of the various other organisational processes that occur, and I feel like I see them clearly, and so I get a little bit distressed and emotional when I feel like it's hard to articulate, actually. But the changes that need to take place that I see, those are the frustrations that I have. At a personal level, this is really dear to my heart, and I feel that quite deeply because I really have, I guess, personalised, I don't know if that's the word though, being on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander country. So I really have understood clearly the history of this continent. I've understood my own white privilege at a level which has really impacted the way in which I think about my work, go about my work, and I interact with First Nations people. And that is at the core of who I am and how I practice. So when I hit heads against some of those structural challenges, that they can be distressing.
So what does that say about, I guess, the values and beliefs and principles that you hold really close to your heart? I'm wondering about what they are that you would get distressed or frustrated knowing what you know and having the relationships that you do. Can you speak about these values, beliefs or principles that you hold close to you?
They are articulated in the framework for practice as well as becoming an ally. So it's in our being honest together. It's interesting. One of the things that the students' outcomes from the student engagement with the elders is their reflection on this is about being human together. Mm-hmm. And it encapsulates for me what this work is really about. So it's about us bringing honesty to the table. It's about us being authentic in our relationships with one another. And I guess this really hit home the very first time I started teaching into the Indigenous Cultures Unit, which is a common core unit here at Curtin, because when I was a new academic, I could hide and shield myself behind my academic self. So I'm Dr. Antonia Hendrick, I've got a PhD, and I could list all of my achievements. I didn't have to talk about myself. Working in this space, you realise that that's the first introduction that you have to an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person. Mm-hmm. This is who I am. This is where I belong. This is my country and this is my family. When I started thinking about that and introducing myself differently in the class, I realised that my whole disposition changed as well. So I went from being quite confident and strong in how I stood, in how my voice was projected, to all of a sudden being vulnerable and feeling emotional. So when I introduced who I am as a person and where I'm from and family, my voice would quiver a bit. And I thought at that moment that actually that's the connection, that's the authentic self that we bring to our teaching space. That's the transformation that can happen between people, regardless of race and our differences. And that for me is the essence of, I think, the work we need to do as social workers with other human beings.
I wonder what it was like to be a student listening to you introduce yourself in that way. I imagine they were wondering what's going on, why are you sharing all this about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they appreciate it. And some of the reflections that you get in Evaluate is that they do respond very well to our humanness together, because I think it's something that they too can relate too, even though it is something that opens up our vulnerabilities with one another. But it's a deeper connection, and you feel that with the engagement with the elders. There is no pretense. There is no hiding behind academic qualifications. It's leaving all of that stuff behind and the white privilege that I am imbued and being real with one another. And we don't have to do that. We can choose to do that if we want to. That's what white privilege is all about.
Yeah.
Taking that to the classroom is modelling, but also asking students to reflect on that for themselves.
So do you think that these values and principles that you hold dear about being honest, being human together, authenticity, being real, were these things that you look back on your life and think, you know, they've been there all the time, I'm just using them in a different way now? Was there a particular experience that you had in your early life where you think, yeah, I can see where these come from?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm born of 10-pound Poms who came and settled in Australia in the late 60s. When they came, they were offered a home, settled into a really lovely community. My father was given a job when he got here. So all those privileges were just offered on a platter when they came. At the very same time, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples were denied those very same rights. So it was soon after being here, and I was born here on Wadjuk Noongar Boodja, that my parents took up a posting in rural Western Australia. And I guess that began for me a lifelong journey of being immersed with Aboriginal cultures. So since I was four, so my parents separated when I was around four or three. And since that time, my family has changed from that nuclear family to include three Aboriginal sisters and their families. And it's growing up with my sisters and their families that I didn't question. I didn't see any differences in us being together. They were their family. They're part of my kin folk and part of my really happy upbringing. Mm-hmm. It wasn't probably until I came to university and I was taking my first anthropology unit before social work, and I sat next to an Aboriginal girl and we were listening for the very first time around the 1905 Act, and it was just appalling. I just could not believe that this was the first time in my whole life that I was listening to a history that had happened here in this country to people and family who I was connected with. And sitting next to this Aboriginal girl, it was the first time she'd heard this as well. And it was just a real poignant time in my life of reflecting on my upbringing with my sisters and with sister in particular. And so when I stand in front of the class now, I think about the fact that I have all this white privilege that got me there. There weren't barriers. There weren't the main challenges along the way. Yet my sister, when we went to, there was 2 years between my next sister down from me. When we went to school together, she was the academic one. She was the studious student who listened, who was attentive, who did all her work, got good grades. And I was the mischievous brat in the classroom. Teachers probably didn't like necessarily. And that's a true story. And yet I'm standing in front of these classrooms as an academic with a PhD where my sister should be standing. But because of the colour of my skin, I was afforded privileges that sadly, and it's heartbreaking, and I get emotional when I think about it. And I think that that's what has driven me since that realization in this work that I do. But I am thankful now that my sister is thinking about coming to university. Things are looking good there.
Oh, wow. That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if your practice, the way you approach your social work today, has also been influenced by other role models. You've already mentioned some authors like Bishop, Landon Singleton. I'm wondering, I don't know if there's been any particular people in your family or your other kind of social network that have influenced your journey on the way.
Yeah, there have been a number. I'd have to say that primarily my parents. My mum is a social worker, and she is one of the co-authors on the paper.
All right.
with me, and so she does a lot of work in this area, so she is my inspiration, and I learn so much from working with herself and my father as well. But there are many other people who work in this space, particularly in WA, who I really look to for guidance, check in with and work closely with in this space as Wodgalas. For self-reflection, I think is really important. You know, what are we doing, why are we doing it, and to what benefit? Some of the questions that I ask. But working with Mum is another story, because through my studying, she was one of the lecturers, and I remember while I was doing social work, concealing from people that mm-hmm. she was my mother, because I wanted to make my own way through the course. Mm. And a few years ago, back in 2011, she and I went and did a joint presentation in Wellington, New Zealand. And one of the colleagues, a close colleague, Shane Walker, who is a Māori man, a social worker, introduced us on stage, and he'd done a lot of work with Mum, and so he held her in high esteem. When we were on stage together, he introduced Mum, and then he introduced me, even though we'd only just met. And he talked about, I don't know Antonia, but she is her daughter. And so he spoke about the relationship and about my upbringing as a result of being the daughter, and how that needs to be cherished and how that needed to be treasured and celebrated. And I reflected on that. It was such a humbling, such an amazing experience. And I reflected back on that and thought, why was it that I was concealing it? And it's because we're in a white society where, you know, individualism is revered, where you need to make your own way in the world, and mm-hmm. you need to do it on your own merits. And we don't bring the relationship, the collective, along with us. We don't treasure that as much as we need to. So it's really made me rethink my relationships with other people. So I would have to say that, you know, there are a number of people, including Shane, who I look up to and as role models in this space and work.
What do you think your mum would say if she was here listening to what you've just shared, the fact that you wanted to make your own way in social work? How do you think she would be looking at it?
She would understand fully, and I have shared that story with her. I think she's proud of the work and respects the work that I do, and I often will reflect and have some hard discussions with her about this work and this space. I look up to her similarly as an elder, and really respect the work and admire what she brings to the table as well. So a lot of my values and beliefs come from that learning, that solid base, I think. Yeah.
I'm thinking about moving forward now, and how do you see the movement of decolonising the profession of social work playing out across Australia? Do you see other universities, I guess, hitting the mark when it comes to incorporating Indigenous content, materials and processes into their social work courses?
It's a great movement at the moment. It's a great time to be doing this work, although it should have been done a long time ago. But currently across the nation, there is more talk now over this last decade of indigenising or decolonising curriculums, not just in social work. Mm-hmm. We see universities that are accepting reconciliation action plans and renewing those to include things like consulting with elders, having an elder in residence, which we have here at Curtin University and other universities have taken on board as well. Mm. We see Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who are being appointed to senior levels within other universities, which is really heartening. So, and some of the discussion around decolonisation, so what does that look like? What does it mean? There's been some articles. And there's a lot of consensus. So myself and the elders of the Reaching Across the Divide, Aboriginal elders and academics working together, known as RAD, which is the project that engaged the students with the elders. So the elders and I went at the beginning of this year to the National Centre for Cultural Competence at the inaugural conference to share the project. What really hit us at that conference was that there are a lot of people wanting to do decolonising work and understanding the importance of that. So other professions and associations are also saying, you know, this is really important for our professions. But knowing how to go about this, how to do that work, was obviously something that is a gap, and people are struggling to find ways of how do we go about this work. RAD is one way that we've been able to do that work. So how we sustain that, how we embed that into the courses long term, is something that needs to continue to build and develop.
Can you speak about what the possibilities are for the future working with your elders group? You've developed some really, really great relationships there. What do you think the future holds for your work together?
The elders, and also as a result of their work in the school and their commitment, has included and extended to their family members, who too have come into the school, sat and yarned with groups of students and staff. So there is a consultancy partnership, I guess, relationship where the elders are being asked to come in, paid, of course. All of this needs is it's really important that it is paid. It's not voluntary. So there is that commitment and there is that partnership at this point in time. There isn't anything that is necessarily concrete, contracted or ongoing other than that process. So they will be consulted on things like, you know, protocols within the school, assessment developments within units, lectures, content, and we here at Curtin are also have a master's qualifying in the middle of next year, starting for the first time, engaging with the elders around, you know, what that looks like and how we embed Indigenous ways of knowing, doing and being will be really important. Looking forward, we are also aiming to secure some funding so that we can continue the work of RAD. There are other universities that are looking at this project and saying this is something we too would like to do. Of course, it would have to take into account the local context for that area. So funding will enable us to do that. So that's our next project together.
Oh, lovely. And so what do you think have been the outcomes for the students of social work now that they've undertaken their degrees with an Indigenised version of the curriculum? What do you think their social work practice frameworks look like now that they wouldn't have had otherwise?
Certainly, as I mentioned before, they reported on greater confidence, skills and knowledge when working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. So what that looks like in practice, and they've shared in their storying, are things like we go to a staff meeting in our organisation and it doesn't start with an acknowledgement. We have now introduced the idea that it needs to start with an acknowledgement of the country on which we are working. So that's one example. Another student shared how being on placement and being on a stall, a community event where they were showcasing their organisation, there was another stall next to them or just not far from them where it was showcasing an Aboriginal organisation. For that student, she reflected that in the past, previous to yarning with the elders in RAD, she wouldn't have approached that stall because she didn't know how to or she didn't feel confident or comfortable, but she was able to do that on placement as a result of RAD. Other students talked about yarning with elders, you know, and taking the time to do that to the point where other staff in the organisation would say, come on, we need to go, or it's going to take you past your working hours, to which the student would reply, this is really important work. If we're going to have a long-term relationship with this person in our organisation, we need to be able to take the time to yarn. So there are some profound examples of how RAD has changed their practice looking into the future. But they all say that this is the beginning. There's still much more learning to happen.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for coming along and sharing your journey, which has been, you know, quite a long one, and I'm sure it's going to continue. Is there anything else that you wanted to share that perhaps I haven't asked you about, Antonia?
It's really enriching and rewarding work, and I think we as social workers, it's vital that we think about how we do this ally work. The skills that we develop are transferable across the population groups that we work with. It's not just Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And there is some really important modular work that is essential that we take up in becoming an ally. So that's really all I would say.
Thank you. And like I said earlier, the resources that you've mentioned and a couple of authors we can get people in touch with, I'll put some links to those in the show notes today. But if people wanted to connect with you directly, maybe they had another question for you or they want to know a little bit more about your work, can they do that either online or in person?
Absolutely. So I've got a profile on the Curtin University website under the School of Occupational Therapy, Social Work and Speech Pathology, and I'm happy for emails at any time and then having a conversation with people from there.
Wonderful. Well, once again, thank you so much for your time. I know that you're a busy little soul, especially at this time of year, having all those papers to mark and get out to people. So, yeah, thanks again, Antonia.
Thank you, Lucy. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphorically-speaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphorically-speaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.